looks uncomfortable and mutters, "Sorry," under his breath. He admits that he doesn't really understand her hurt at these times. Kyoko hits the emotional elevator button and goes down a few more floors. She begins, "I feel so very sad. We cannot seem to come together anymore." Charlie nods his head and responds, "But you should not be, because we're working on our relationship." He catches himself, shakes his head, and continues, "I think I will try to learn about your hurt. What was the worst moment, the worst feeling for you?" This was a very good question, and by asking it, Charlie helped Kyoko get to the heart of the matter. But Kyoko cannot answer. She sits silently, and large tears roll down her face. Charlie pats her knee. "I only say you're crazy because I get scared of the bad feelings between us," he whispers. Kyoko tells him, "The worst moments were when you put the phone down, and later when you said you would leave. I was so unreasonable, you said." Charlie, now very worried, says, "I don't know how to make this better. What shall I do?" he asks, turning to me. "To make it better, Kyoko needs to feel that you are here with her," I reply, "to let her know you care about her pain." He opens his eyes wide in disbelief. She continues, "If I am sad or scared or upset with you, you just turn off. You don't comfort me. And now you don't make love or hold me either. Just when I need you, you go off in your disapproval. You turn away and discard me. I am not the wife you want." It is hard to listen to Kyoko's outpouring of rejection and abandonment. No wonder she sometimes loses her balance and gets stuck in angry protests or in depression. But here she's clear and precise. "It kills me when you pass over me, turn to your rules. I have never been more alone." Now she looks up directly at him. "Charlie, you're not there for me, with me, so I panic. Do you hear me?" He reaches for her hands and holds them in his. He nods again and again. "Yes, yes, yes." Very quietly, Charlie tells her, "This is sad to hear this. I am sad." And he is. His emotional presence is as tangible as the chair he sits on. Kyoko has turned her clear awareness of her deeper emotions into a clear attachment signal to her lover. She has distilled her deepest pain, the primal code of loss and panic that sounds when our loved one is not there for us, and he has heard her. Both partners have connected with their own emotional realities and opened up to each other. Play and practice. Charlie does a number of things that make a real difference in how he connects with and shares his deeper emotions. See if you can recall or go back and find examples of the following. Charlie starts to examine the present moment and how hard it is to connect with his feelings. What's blocking him from saying how he feels? Charlie identifies some handles from previous conversations and holds the images, phrases, or feelings up to the light. When he looks at them closely, he can see that they are really descriptions of fear, shame, or sadness and loss. Charlie identifies terrible ifs, the worst things that might happen if he acknowledges his partner's feelings. Listing catastrophic consequences uncovers his worst core fears that he'll be helpless and alone. This is a key part of conversation 4. Charlie reveals his fears to his wife and reflects on what it is like to share these deep feelings with her. Now look at Kyoko's revelations and try to answer these questions. What was the worst moment for Kyoko? What is the catastrophic conclusion she comes to? Name 4 things that Charlie does when Kyoko is sad and scared that heighten her attachment fears. Kyoko describes them in simple action words. What are Kyoko's 2 core emotions? Go back to a rocky moment in your current relationship and find your own handles and write them down. Ask your partner to do the same. Then sit with your partner. Which one of you is the most withdrawn? This partner begins the conversation. This is because it is harder for more actively protesting partners, who are usually more tuned in to their hurts and fears, to begin reaching out without some sign of engagement from their more reserved lover. If you are the more reserved partner, follow in Charlie's steps and tune into your core fears, share them, and say what it feels like to reveal them. If you are the listening partner, respond by saying what it was like to hear the disclosures. Was it easy or hard to understand the message? If it was hard, at what point did it become difficult to listen? What feeling came up then? Examine the feelings together. Now the listening partner repeats the disclosure process. This conversation will be especially beneficial for distressed couples, but it is also valuable to those in secure relationships. We all have attachment fears, even if they have no edge or urgency at the moment. Above all, keep in mind that this is a sensitive conversation. You are both exposing your deepest vulnerability. You each must respect the risk the other is taking. Remember, the two of you are taking this step because you're special to each other and are trying to create a very special kind of bond between you. What do I need most from you? Being able to declare our core attachment fears naturally leads to a recognition of our primary attachment needs. Fear and longing are two sides of the same coin. The second part of Conversation 4 involves directly stating the attachment needs that right now only your partner can satisfy. This conversation can be smooth and easy, or it can be fraught with doubt. It's one thing to acknowledge and accept your own emotional reality, but another to open it up to your partner. This is a great leap for those of us who have had little experience of real safety with others. So why do it? Because we long for connection, and remaining defended and isolated is a sad and empty way to live. The author, Anaïs Nin, expresses the idea beautifully. And the day came when the risk to remain tight in the bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom. Rosemary, a client, puts it another way. In Canada, we play hockey. Sometimes we even think of life as a hockey game. Rosemary, an avid player, turns to her partner, Andre, and tells him, "I am wearing this face mask, and I have to drop it if I want you to understand what I need and ask you for what I want." Some part of me says that opening up like that is just asking to be smashed in the face like I was in that hockey game last month. Keeping the mask up is not because I don't love you or that you're a bad partner. It's because I always play defense. To turn and ask, that's a whole new position. That is scary. But if I'm honest, I'm empty behind the mask. Can't win the game that way either. Let's return to Charlie and Kyoko and see how they wend their way through this crucial part of Conversation 4. I prompt Charlie, "What do you need from Kyoko right now to feel more, as you put it, safe and secure? What do you long for, Charlie? Can you tell Kyoko exactly what you need from her?" He considers for a moment, then turns toward her and begins, "I need to know that when I'm not the perfect husband and get confused, do not know what to do, you still want to be with me. Maybe that you want me even if you're upset. Even if I get overwhelmed and make mistakes, hurt your feelings, I need to know you'll not leave me. When you're depressed or very mad, it seems like you've already gone. Yes, this is right. I've said it right." And then, as if suddenly realizing the risk he's taken, he turns away and nervously rubs his knees. He says quietly, "This is very hard for me to ask. I've never asked anyone for such a thing." The obvious emotion on Charlie's face moves Kyoko. She responds softly but firmly, "Charlie, I'm here with you. That's all I want, to be with you. I do not need a perfect husband. If we can talk like this, we can be close again. That's all I've ever wanted. Charlie looks relieved and a little dazed. He giggles and says, Oh, now that is good. That is very reasonable indeed. She giggles with him. When it is Kyoko's turn to state her needs, she starts by discussing how she now knows that her desire for reassurance and comfort is proper, even natural. This helps her think about what she needs from Charlie. But then she veers off course. Looking at the ceiling, she speaks in the third person. I think I want him to... I stop her and ask her to listen to her deepest feelings, turn her chair toward Charlie, and look and speak directly at him. Kyoko turns to Charlie and takes a deep breath. I want you to accept that I am more emotional than you, and that this is okay. It is not a flaw in me. There's nothing wrong with me that I do not find comfort in reasons and shoulds. I want you to stay with me and come close, to show me you care when I don't feel strong. I want you to touch me and hold me and tell me I matter to you. I just want you to be with me. That is all I need. Charlie looks completely stunned. He says,
You mean you just want me to come close?
Kyoko asks him, What is it like to hear me say these things? He shakes his head.
It's like I've been working so hard to keep us on this one track that I've not seen the simple, easy way just off to the side here.
Then he smiles softly.
This feels good. It's better. I can do this. I can do this with you.
Both Charlie and Kyoko are now tuned in to their core needs and can give coherent signals about these needs to their partner. They can do what securely attached partners can do, by knowing and trusting their own emotions and reaching past their fears. They're stronger individually and together. When couples can do this, they can more easily repair conflicts and rifts and shape a nurturing, loving connection. Charlie and Kyoko have not only become accessible, responsive, and engaged with each other, they have also expanded their sense of who they are individually. Kyoko is more assertive, and Charlie is more flexible. Now that they know how to invite each other into an ARE conversation, they can help each other grow on a personal level. Let's take a look at key moments in the Hold Me Tight conversations of two other couples. These pairs have more troubled personal histories and a more fragile sense of emotional safety than do Charlie and Kyoko. Yet they, too, are able to make this call from the heart. Diane and David have fought for their relationship for 35 years through the fog of fear, deprivation, and depression left over from their histories of abuse and violation by those they needed the most. At the beginning of our sessions, Diane told David, I have to leave. I can't be badgered every time you get scared. Going to my room for days on end doesn't work anymore. I can't live behind this wall. Now, in the Hold Me Tight conversation, she says to David, I love you. I do want to be close, but I cannot be pushed into closeness. I want to feel safe with you. I want you to give me the room to move, to hear when I tell you I'm getting overwhelmed. You trying to move my feet in tune with yours doesn't work. After all these years, I want you to believe that I won't let you go, us go. When we dance together, it's lovely. I want you to help me feel safe with you, and then to ask, to reach for me. Then I can turn to you and we can dance. When it is David's turn to talk about his needs, rather than channeling his attachment anxiety into hostile comments about Diane, he talks about his fear of loss and the other side of his fear, his longing for connection. He has a coherent message, one that takes his wife into account and that clearly reflects his deepest emotions and needs. This is secure talk. There's no flipping into reactive anger or avoiding by intellectualizing. He can now reach for his wife.
"I don't know how to say this," he begins. "It's like when I was in the military and I was jumping out of planes. Except here, there's no parachute. I'm a fearful person, Diane. I've learned to watch for danger all the time. I guess it's so hard for me to not go straight into take charge mode. But now I know how my taking charge has made it hard for you and pushed you away." He's silent for a few moments, then continues, "So some part of me is always afraid that you can't really love me. I'm always pushing for that acknowledgement that I matter to you. I'm always wanting that reassurance, wanting to know that I'm loved, even with all my problems, my temper. But it's so hard for me to ask. I'm in free fall here. I need that certainty, and it's so hard for me to ask. Can you love me, even with all my problems?" Diane's face shows that she sees his pain and fear, and she leans toward him and says very slowly and deliberately, "I love you, David. I have loved you since I was 16. I wouldn't know how to stop now. When you talk like this, I want to hold you forever." Huge smiles erupt on their faces. Philippe and Tabitha are very different from David and Diane. They both had unhappy first marriages and are heavily invested in their very successful, high-profile careers. The crisis in their 5-year relationship is that each time they go to move in together, Philippe changes his mind. They're both highly intellectual, accomplished people who tend to withdraw whenever any tension arises. Philippe pulls his expensive fedora hat down over his eyes and retreats into his religion and platonic friendships with other women, while Tabitha shops for more elegant suits and artwork or immerses herself in a frenzy of work projects. Both are a little surprised that they cannot seem to walk away from each other, and Tabitha has finally given Philippe an ultimatum: move in, or the relationship is over. Philippe's initial position is captured by his statement, "I do not believe in needing people. I decided long ago that this was just foolishness. I have many friends, and I'm best on my own. I've never known how to do all this lovey-dovey nonsense." Now he tells Tabitha, "I understand that every time we get really close, when commitment comes up, some part of me goes into panic and slams the door. I think I decided a very long time ago never again to put all my eggs in one basket, never to give anyone that power to hurt me, to crush me again. It's very hard for me to admit that I want your caring, to place myself in your hands. Even now, as I say that, there's an ocean of weeping waiting for me here. I need to know that you will not ever just turn away and shut me out. I can see myself as a small boy being told to go away when my mother became ill. In a sense, that little boy is the one who tells me to run when I begin to feel this need for you. I want to let you come close. Can you help me learn to trust? Can you tell me that you will not turn away no matter what?" Tabitha is able to do just that, and to keep doing that as this couple move into deeper connection. When it's her turn to engage in an ARE conversation, she's able to say, "On some level, I know that you get pulled away from me by your fear, but I have to know that I'm important enough to you that you will fight that fear. I cannot deal with all this uncertainty. It hurts too much. I want you to invest in us, in our connection. I love you, and I think you can trust me. But I need that stability, a place that I can count on with you. It's hard for me to say this. I get afraid that I'm not good enough, perfect enough to make this kind of claim on you. I get caught in how it is maybe my fault that you're still afraid, and that maybe I want too much. I think in the past this has stopped me drawing this line. Do I really deserve this? Am I entitled? Well, whether I am or not, I want your commitment that you will let me matter to you.
I can't risk any more without that safe place. It's too scary, too painful. I want you to risk and open up to me. I won't let you down.
Philippe, visibly moved by her words, replies in a soft voice, Yes, I think you want to be with me, and you do deserve for me to take this risk. I've been caught up in my own fear, too afraid to really open up, but I cannot lose you. So I'm investing, and it's scary, and I'm here.
Once Philippe is able to give her this reassurance in an engaged, loving way, this relationship opens out into a secure base for both of them. The neuroscience of harmony. My research shows that every time a couple has a hold-me-tight conversation, a moment of deep emotional connection occurs. Physicists speak of resonance, a sympathetic vibration between two elements that allows them to suddenly synchronize signals and act in a new harmony. It's the same vibration that I hear in the climaxes of a Bach sonata when 100 musical tones come together. Every cell in my body responds, making me and the music one. When I observe similar moments between mother and child, between lovers, between people who reach for and find a deep connection, my response is always the same. I feel a sudden joy. That sense of connection is expressed not just in our feelings, but also in our very cells. As partners respond empathetically to each other, I know from recent research that specific nerve cells called mirror neurons in the prefrontal cortex of their brains are buzzing. These neurons appear to be one of the basic mechanisms that allow us to actually feel what someone else is experiencing. This is a different level of understanding than grasping someone's experience through our intellect. When we watch a person act, these brain cells fire off just as though we were performing the action ourselves. Mirror neurons are part of our general wired-to-connect heritage, and they prime us for love and loving. Neuroscientists discovered mirror neurons by accident in 1992 when a researcher who was mapping a monkey's brain and eating an ice cream cone noticed that the monkey's brain lit up as if he were eating the cone. The neurons allow us to read intentions and emotions to bring another inside us. Neuroscientists, borrowing from physics, now speak of reverberating states of empathic resonance. This sounds very abstract. What it means for lovers is that there is a tangible power in actually looking at each other. It helps us be emotionally present and pick up on our partner's nonverbal cues. This creates a level of engagement and empathy that is lost in a less direct conversation. Mirror neurons allow us to see emotion expressed by another and feel this emotion within our own body. It is scientific validation for the attachment concept that authentic connection is about feeling felt. At the beginning of their sessions, Charlie and Kyoko did not resonate. They hardly looked at each other, and they seemed to speak a different language. During their hold-me-tight conversation, however, as the corners of Charlie's mouth turned down and his eyelids drooped, Kyoko's eyelids also began to droop. As he laughed, she smiled. His emotional song became a duet. This kind of responsiveness seems to be at the core of empathic emotion, where we literally feel for and with another, and therefore naturally act more lovingly. This is surely the same kind of engagement of mind, body, and emotion that happy lovers feel when they make love, or that a mother and baby feel when they gaze, touch, and coo. They're moving in emotional synchrony, without conscious thought or spoken word. There is calmness and joy. Mirror neurons aren't the entire explanation. A substantial number of recent studies add to our understanding of the neurochemical basis of attachment. This research shows that in moments of responsive emotional engagement, our brains are flooded with oxytocin, dubbed the cuddle hormone, oxytocin, which is produced only by mammals, is associated with states of contented bliss. It seems to create a cascade of pleasure, comfort, and calm. Researchers discovered the power of oxytocin when they compared the mating habits of two different kinds of prairie voles. In one species, males and females are monogamous, rear their young together, and form lifelong bonds. In the other, males and females take the one-night stand approach and leave offspring to fend for themselves. The faithful rodents, it turns out, produce oxytocin. Their promiscuous cousins do not. However, when scientists gave monogamous voles a chemical that counteracts oxytocin, these little animals had sex but didn't bond with their partners. And when researchers gave the same rodents extra oxytocin, they bonded tightly, whether they mated or not. In humans, oxytocin is released when we're in proximity to or physical contact with an attachment figure, especially during moments of heightened emotion, such as orgasm and breastfeeding. Kirsten Uvnäs Moberg, a Swedish neuroendocrinologist, discovered that merely thinking about loved ones can trigger a rush of oxytocin. Oxytocin also reduces the release of stress hormones like cortisol. Preliminary studies indicate that giving humans oxytocin increases the tendency to trust and interact with others. These findings help explain my observation that once distressed partners learn to hold each other tight, they continue reaching out to each other, trying to create these transforming and satisfying moments again and again. I believe that ARE interactions turn on this neurochemical love potion honed by millions of years of evolution. Oxytocin seems to be nature's way of promoting attachment. Play and practice. Listen to the description of Charlie and Kyoko taking the leap into secure connection again. On your own, focus on a past secure relationship with a lover, a parent, or a close friend. Imagine that person is in front of you now. What would you tell him or her is your deepest attachment need? How do you think he or she would have answered? Now, consider a past relationship where you did not feel securely connected. What was it that you really needed from this person? Try to express this in two simple sentences. How would he or she have replied? Now move on to your relationship with your current partner. Think about what you most need in order to feel secure and loved. Write it down. Then begin this conversation for real with your partner. Here is a list of some of the phrases partners use in this conversation. If it helps you, you can simply choose the one that most fits for you and show it to your partner. I need to feel to sense that. I am special to you and that you really value our relationship. I need that reassurance that I am number one with you and that nothing is more important to you than us. I am wanted by you as a partner and a lover, that making me happy is important to you. I am loved and accepted with my failings and imperfections. I can't be perfect for you. I am needed. You want me close. I am safe because you care about my feelings, hurts, and needs. I can count on you to be there for me, to not leave me alone when I need you the most. I will be heard and respected. Please don't dismiss me or leap into thinking the worst of me. Give me a chance to learn how to be with you. I can count on you to hear me and to put everything else aside. I can ask you to hold me and to understand that just asking is very hard for me. If this is too hard to do, take a smaller step and talk about how difficult it is to explicitly formulate and state your needs. Tell your partner if there is some way he or she can help you with this. This dialogue contains the key emotional drama of our lives, so sometimes we need to edge up to it slowly. If you are the partner who is listening
and you find yourself unsure as to how to respond or too anxious to respond, just share this. Being present is the secret here, rather than responding in any set way. Confirming that you have heard your partner's message, that you appreciate that he or she is sharing with you, and that you want to be responsive is a positive first step. Then you can explore how you might begin to meet your lover's needs. With your partner, discuss which of the other couple's stories, David and Diane's or Philippe and Tabitha's, resonated most with you. After the two of you have had your own hold-me-tight conversation, write down the key statements each of you made. In a heterosexual couple, the female partner will probably find this task easier. Women have been shown in many studies to retain stronger and more vivid memories of emotional events than do men. This appears to be a reflection of physiological differences in the brain, not a sign of the level of involvement in the relationship. If necessary, the women can assist the men a little here. The key statements will help the two of you further clarify your internal and external dramas and guide you in future hold-me-tight conversations. The hold-me-tight conversation is a positive bonding event. It offers an antidote to moments of disengagement and negative cycles and enables you to face the world together as a team. But more than this, each time you can create these moments of emotional resonance, the bond between you grows stronger. The power of these conversations to connect and transform our relationships is clear. Such exchanges have an impact on all other aspects of relationships, as you'll see in the following conversations. Conversation 5. Forgiving injuries. Everyone says that forgiveness is a lovely idea until they have something to forgive. C.S. Lewis. Conrad and his wife Helen are deep into the hold-me-tight conversation, and the air is buzzing with emotional resonance. "Let me hold you," Conrad entreats. "Tell me what you need." Helen turns to him and smiles as if ready to respond to his request. But suddenly her face goes blank. She stares at the floor. And then, in a detached voice, she says, "And I was there. I was sitting on the stairs and I said to you, 'The doctor thinks I probably have it. Breast cancer. I've been waiting all my life, knowing it was coming. My mother died of it. My grandmother, too. And now it's come for me.'" Her voice changes. She sounds bewildered. "And you brushed past me as I sat there." She touches her shoulder as if still feeling the touch. "And you said, 'Get yourself together. There's no point in freaking out and getting all upset when you're not sure. Just calm down and we can discuss what to do later.' You went upstairs to your office and closed the door. You didn't come down for the longest time. You left me sitting alone. You left me dying on the stairs." Then her voice changes again. In a cheery, business-like tone, she tells me that she and Conrad have made great progress in therapy and no longer have the terrible fights that brought them in to see me. In fact, things are so much better that there probably isn't much more to discuss. Conrad is confused and puzzled by what has just happened. The stairway conversation occurred more than 3 years ago, and the doctor's suspicions were wrong. Helen did not have breast cancer. Eager not to stir up trouble, he quickly agrees with his wife's assessment that therapy is going fine and there's nothing to discuss. Small events, big fallout. I have seen this sort of abrupt disconnect occur before. Couples are making steady progress, tender feelings are flowing, and then, wham! One partner brings up an event, sometimes an apparently minor one, and it's as if all the oxygen has been sucked from the room. All at once, warm hope is exchanged for chill despair. How can one small incident have this kind of overwhelming power? Well, clearly, it's not a minor incident. To one partner, at least, it's a grievous event.
Over the decades of research and therapy, I've discovered that certain incidents do more than just touch our raw spots or hurt our feelings. They injure us so deeply that they overturn our world. They are relationship traumas. In the dictionary, a trauma is defined as a wound that plunges us into fear and helplessness, that challenges all our assumptions of predictability and control. Traumatic wounds are especially severe, observes Judith Herman, professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, when they involve a violation of human connection. Indeed, there is no greater trauma than to be wounded by the very people we count on to support and protect us. Helen and Conrad have come face to face with a relationship trauma. Even though the stairway encounter was 3 years back, it has remained very much alive, nixing any possibility of Helen reaching for her husband. In fact, since the incident, Helen has been irritable and wary with Conrad, swinging from vividly recalling the incident to numbing out and avoiding closeness. Hypervigilance, flashbacks, and avoidance are the established indicators of traumatic stress. When Helen did try to discuss her feelings, Conrad minimized the incident, leaving her even more upset. So now, when Conrad asks Helen to risk with him, to put herself in his hands, she instantly remembers the time when she was totally vulnerable with him. An alarm sounds, and she refuses to go there again. I call this the never-again moment. No wonder the hold-me-tight conversation hits a dead end. Lack of an emotionally supportive response by a loved one at a moment of threat can color a whole relationship, observe attachment researchers Jeff Simpson of the University of Minnesota and Stephen Rolls of Texas A&M University. It can eclipse hundreds of smaller positive events and, in one swipe, demolish the security of a love relationship. The power of such incidents lies in the searing negative answer they offer to the eternal questions, are you there for me when I am most in need? Do you care about my pain? There isn't much room for compromise or ambiguity when we feel this kind of urgent need for our loved one's support. The test is pass or fail. These moments can shatter all our positive assumptions about love itself and our loved one's dependability, beginning the fall into relationship distress or further fraying an already fragile bond. Until these incidents are confronted and resolved, true accessibility and emotional engagement are out of the question. When I and my colleagues first started watching tapes of hold-me-tight conversations, we thought that wounds that bleed the life out of a relationship were always betrayals. Except betrayal didn't seem to fit exactly when we listened to injured partners probe their pain. There have been lots of hurts and hard times in our relationship, Francine explains to Joseph, who has had an affair with a colleague. I can accept that you felt neglected after the twins were born, and that you were sexually frustrated when you met this woman. I can even understand how your relationship with her kind of just unfolded, pulling you in. It's not the affair itself that is the big problem for me. What I can't get past is how you told me about it. I think about it all the time. You saw how devastated I was. I was literally on the floor. And when I was most down, what did you do? You blamed me for your affair. You listed all my bad qualities and went on and on discussing possibilities for how your life might take shape without me. It was as if I wasn't even there. You didn't take me into account at all. That is the piece I keep going back to. If you had ever loved me at all, then how could you do that? Plainly, Francine is distressed by more than Joseph's infidelity and disloyalty. I've come to see that although wounded partners often do feel betrayed, they primarily feel abandoned by their mate. Their cries are usually some version of, "How could you leave me in that life and death moment?" Partners typically suffer relationship trauma at times of intense emotional stress when attachment needs are naturally high, including the birth or miscarriage of a child, the death of a parent, the sudden loss of a job, the diagnosis and treatment of serious illness. The mates who inflict these injuries are not being malicious or purposely insensitive. Indeed, they usually have the best of intentions. Most simply do not know how to tune in to their loved one's attachment needs and offer the comfort of their emotional presence. Some, too, are absorbed by attempts to contain their own anxiety. As Sam sadly tells his wife, "When I saw all that blood, I just freaked out. I didn't even think of losing the baby. I thought you were going to die. I was going to lose you. I went into problem-solving mode. I left you alone in the back of the taxi and sat in front with the driver giving him directions to the hospital. I didn't understand what you needed from me." Partners often try to handle relationship injuries by ignoring or burying them. That is a big mistake. Everyday hurts are easily dismissed, and raw spots can fade away if we stop rubbing them in demon dialogues, but unresolved traumas do not heal. The helplessness and fear they engender are almost indelible. They set off our survival instincts. It's wiser, in survival terms, to be wary and discover there is no real danger than to be trusting and find out the danger is real. This wariness will limit an injured partner's ability to risk deeper emotional engagement, and the traumas fester. The more Helen demands an apology from Conrad for leaving her on the stairs, the more Conrad offers dismissing rationalizations. That only confirms her sense of isolation and feeds her anger. Sometimes partners do succeed in compartmentalizing traumas, but this results in a cool and distant relationship, and the barricade works only for a while. Injured feelings break out at some point when attachment needs come to the fore. Larry, a high-powered executive, had neglected his wife Susan for years. Since retiring, he had been trying to court Susan. They had improved their relationship, but in the hold-me-tight conversation, when Larry reached for his wife's comfort, she exploded. She told him that after his actions in the kitchen on Morris Street, she had resolved to never again let him close enough to hurt her. Larry does not have any idea what Susan is talking about, but he knows that they've not lived on Morris Street for 17 years. Susan hasn't forgotten what happened on one hot afternoon. She'd been depressed, physically ill from a car accident, and overwhelmed with caring for their three small children. Larry had come home to find her weeping on the kitchen floor. Although normally a very reserved woman, she had begged him to hold her. He had told her to pull herself together and had gone off to make phone calls. Susan tells Larry, "That afternoon, lying there, I came to the end of weeping. I went cold. I told myself I would never make the mistake of expecting that kind of caring from you again. I would rely on my sisters, and all these years you never even noticed, and now, suddenly, you need me and want me to open up?" The only way out of these attachment injuries is to confront them and heal them together, preferably immediately. This was brought home to me when my then 8-year-old son came down with acute appendicitis at a summer lake party my husband John and I were hosting. I dashed off to the nearest hospital with instructions to John to shut down the party and follow us. The small local hospital could not operate, and we had to make a long and anxious trip into town. By the time we got there, things looked bad. The surgeon hurried in to look at my son and announced that he had to operate now. I called my husband again, and he was still at the lake. 2 hours later, as I was watching my son being wheeled into intensive care, my husband came waltzing breezily down the corridor. I ignited. He was horrified that I had been so scared and felt so alone. He tolerated my anger and distress, explained why he was late, and reassured me. Still,
I needed to be very sure that he understood my hurt. We went over the incident quite a few times in the following weeks before this injury was fully healed. For Conrad and Helen, the healing process begins in my office when he reveals that after he left her on the stairs, he had wept for an hour. He had thought that allowing his own fear and impotence to show would be letting her down. Until now, he has hidden his shame while vainly trying to persuade his wife that she does not hurt. The first goal for partners is forgiveness. Just as with love, forgiveness has only recently become a topic of study by social scientists. Most scholars speak of forgiveness as a moral decision. Letting go of resentment and absolving a person's bad conduct is the right and good thing to do. But this decision alone will not restore faith in the injuring person and the relationship. What partners need is a special type of healing conversation that fosters not just forgiveness, but the willingness to trust again. Renewed trust is the ultimate goal. About 5 years ago, I began mapping out the steps in the dance of forgiveness and reconciliation. Together with my students and colleagues, I watched tapes of counseling sessions and saw how some couples hit the never again moment and got stuck, and others worked through the injury. We learned that couples had to be able to manage conversations 1 to 3 and create a basic safety in their relationship before they could engage in a forgiving injuries conversation. A recent research project has further sharpened our understanding of relationship traumas. We've learned that they're not always obvious, that what's important is not the events themselves, but the vulnerabilities they arouse. For some partners at certain times, a flirtation may prove more wounding than an affair. We've also found that couples can suffer multiple traumas, and that the greater the number, the harder it is to renew trust. The overriding lesson is you have to take your partner's hurt seriously and hang in and ask questions until the meaning of an incident becomes clear, even if to you the event seems trivial or the hurt exaggerated. Mary and Ralph have identified their demon dialogues and can talk about their raw spots and replay rocky moments, but Mary is balking at starting the hold-me-tight conversation. Instead, she keeps harping on the racy photos of Ralph and secretaries in their underwear at an office party that he left in his desk drawer at home, which he knows she regularly tidies. Ralph apologizes, admits that the party got a little out of hand and that the photos are inappropriate, but he is adamant that no hanky-panky went on. He doesn't really understand why she's so hurt. He keeps trying to tune in to Mary's story and finally picks up on the fact that Mary keeps repeating the phrase, "right then, after that time." "What's so important about the timing of all this?" he asks. Mary bursts into tears. "How can you ask that? Do you not remember? It was after those terrible discussions where you told me that I just was too inhibited for you. You demanded that I go out and get some silky underwear and read some of those sex books. I grew up in such a strict home. I told you that I was just too shy to do this, but you insisted. You told me that unless I did this, we weren't going to make it as a couple. So I went and did it for us. I did it all, but I was so ashamed, so mortified. And you didn't seem to really notice. You never even said you were pleased, not once. But you looked really pleased posing in those photos, and those girls looked like they were having fun. They weren't shy like me. I turned myself inside out to be like those girls in the photos, and it didn't matter. And the very last thing was that you knew I cleaned out your desk, and you never even thought how I would feel if I found the photos. I was just invisible to you." Ralph now tunes in to his wife's pain. He reaches out to hold her hand and comfort her. Both Mary and Ralph showed courage and determination here in sifting through an event until its import became evident. Sometimes we don't know what is so painful to us in a particular event until we can really explore it with our partner. And sometimes it's very hard to just come out and show the core of our hurt to the one who hurt us. But the pain always makes sense if we relate it to our attachment needs and fears. 6 steps to forgiveness. What are the steps in the forgiving injuries conversation? 1. The hurt partner needs to speak his or her pain as openly and simply as possible. This is not always easy to do. It means resisting making a case against your partner and staying focused on describing the pain, the specific situation in which it occurred, and how it affects your sense of safety with your partner. When it's hard to capture the essence of an injury, we try to help people plug into the emotions that arose by asking the following questions. At a moment of urgent need, did I feel deprived of comfort? Did I feel deserted and alone? Did I feel devalued by my partner when I desperately needed validation that I and my feelings were important? Did my partner suddenly appear to be a source of danger to me, rather than the haven of safety that I needed? This speaks directly to the traumatic nature of attachment injuries. Sorting through the emotional soup to find the essence of your hurt can be difficult, and it's just as hard for the guilty partner to hang in and try to hear the other's anguish. Having already explored your demon dialogues and your individual raw spots should help each of you tune in when the other is sharing, even if what's being said triggers your anxiety. Once the two of you are able to understand the underlying attachment hurts, needs, and fears that are being played out, you can slow down and help each other work through them. After months of recriminations, Vera is finally able to tell Ted, "Never mind those times when it was hard for you to come with me to the chemotherapy. I know that this cancer thing sends you back to being 12 years old and watching your mom, the only person who ever cared for you, die of cancer. The image that just stops my breath is the day when I came home and cried and cried. I told you that I couldn't go on anymore, and you said nothing. You did nothing. But then my sister came over, remember? And she got all upset and burst into tears, and you leapt up out of your chair to comfort her. You held her. You whispered to her." Vera bursts into breathless sobs, then continues, "You did it, but not with me. Your comfort, your touch wasn't for me. That night I told myself I'd rather die alone than ask you for that kind of caring again. But that pain is still here, and I am still all alone with it." Ted stares at Vera, suddenly comprehending her grief and rage. This is a terrible message, but at least it makes sense. Vera has pinpointed the wound. Ted has seen it. Now the healing can begin. 2. The injuring partner stays emotionally present and acknowledges the wounded partner's pain and his or her part in it. Until injured partners see that this pain has been truly recognized, they will not be able to let it go. They will call again and again to their partner, preoccupied with protesting and demanding. This makes perfect sense if we understand attachment. If you do not see how you've hurt me, how can I depend on you or feel safe with you? In past discussions of the trauma, the injuring partner may have retreated into shame and self-blame. It helps to remember that in love, mistakes are inevitable. We all sometimes miss our loved ones' calls for closeness. We all find ourselves distracted. We all get stuck in our own fear or anger and fail to catch loved ones as they fall. There is no perfect soulmate, no flawless lover. We're all stumbling around, treading on each other's toes as we're learning to love. Perhaps a partner has never before tuned in to attachment messages and only now really begins to understand the pain he or she has caused. It's important to remember that even though the incident happened in the past, an injuring partner can change how it affects the future. Letting the wounded lover understand the injuring partner's response helps to restore predictability, and staying emotionally present allows the hurt partner to deal with pain in a different way. Ted says, "Now I'm getting it. The last few times we talked about this, I was able to tell you how your cancer made me freeze like a deer in the headlights. It was like a replay of when my mom was sick. But you're right. That day you watched me just up and give your sister the support you were starving for." Vera nods and weeps, and he sees this, and his voice softens. "That was unbearable for you." She nods again. "That was worse even than my freezing up. I did not, and still do not, really offer comfort to you, even when I see you hurting. How come I don't do that? I guess it's the way I see you. You're so strong, stronger than I am for sure. I know it's really stupid, but I think it was easier to reach for your sister right then, just because every time I looked at you, all I saw was my own loss and helplessness, because you are so important to me." Vera considers this for a moment, and then lifts her mouth into a tentative smile. 3. Partners start reversing the never again dictum. I think of it as couples revising their script. Vera moves out from behind her protective wall and shares with Ted the depth of her loneliness, grief, and despair. She tells him, "The day after this incident, I decided that all this was too hard for you. I wasn't sure if you really cared if I made it through, so the battle with the cancer was suddenly pointless. I thought of just giving up." As she speaks, she watches Ted's face. He looks hurt, too. He tells her, "I don't want you to feel this way, and I can't bear that you thought of giving up. Giving up because I couldn't comfort you. That's terrible." 4. Injuring partners now take ownership of how they inflicted this injury on their lover and express regret and remorse. This cannot take the form of an impersonal or defensive apology. Saying, "Look, I'm sorry, okay?" in a cool tone doesn't signify regret, only dismissal of the partner's pain. If we want to be believed here, we have to listen to and engage with our lover's pain as expressed in step 3. We have to show that our lover's pain has an impact on us. When Ted turns to Vera and speaks, you can hear sadness and remorse in his voice and see it on his face. He tells her, "I really let you down, didn't I? I wasn't there for you. I'm so sorry, Vera. I got all overwhelmed and left you to stare down your enemy by yourself. It's hard for me to admit this. I don't want to see myself as the kind of person, the kind of husband, who would let you down like this. But I did it. You had a right to get angry. I never saw my support as that important, but I know now that I hurt you very badly. I wasn't sure what to do, so I dithered and did nothing. I want to try to make this better, if you will let me." Vera is obviously very moved by Ted's apology. What does he do that is so effective here? First, his manner makes it clear that he feels and cares about Vera's pain. Second, he explicitly tells her that her hurt and her anger are legitimate. Third, he owns up to exactly what he did that was so hurtful. Fourth, he expresses shame. He tells his wife that he too feels dismayed and disappointed by his behavior. Fifth, he reassures her that he will now be there to help her heal. Now that is one stellar apology. It took me 3 tries to get just half of what Ted included into an apology to my daughter after I had badly hurt her feelings. Ted's apology is not just a statement of contrition. It is an invitation to reconnect.
5. A hold-me-tight conversation can now take place, centering around the attachment injury. Injured partners identify what they need right now to bring closure to the trauma. They then directly ask for these needs to be met, that is, for their lovers to respond differently from the way they did in the original incident. This shapes a new sense of